Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saves.
Thank you, Lori. As I said to His Eminence as we were waiting to come in, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, if there are any angels in heaven, they're all nurses. We know from our family experience what you do, the courage, and the pain you absorb for others. So thank you. Thank you.
I'm San Francisco Chronicle columnist Heather Knight, and you're listening to Fifth and Mission. You just heard Lori Marie Key, a nurse from outside Detroit, sing Amazing Grace. And Joe Biden praised her and other nurses afterwards for their dedication and courage during the COVID-19 pandemic. The song and speech were a part of the National Memorial to Lives Lost to COVID-19 in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday night, the day before Biden's inauguration as President of the United States. Will Biden's empathy make a difference? How quickly can he and Kamala Harris get our country on the right track in its response to COVID-19? Can they get the vaccine out more quickly and in a more organized fashion? George Rutherford, an infectious disease doctor with UCSF, joins me to answer these questions. Dr. George Rutherford, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Nice to see you.
So as we're speaking on Tuesday evening, there was just a memorial service for people who have died of COVID in Washington, D.C., and President-elect Joe Biden made some emotional remarks about how much he has appreciated nurses, their courage and dedication over the past year. He got a little emotional talking about how he's appreciated nurses ever since losing his own family members in a car crash decades ago. And we've never heard these kinds of remarks from President Trump. Was just wondering, whatever your politics, do you think empathy and caring and these kinds of emotions from the White House will make a difference in our ongoing battle against COVID-19?
I think it'd make a huge difference. I mean, you know, people are, people have been working at this since February and March. It's tough to go to work every day. It's tough to get up and do the same thing over and over and over again, and especially if you're at personal risk. So I think Hearing the president-elect and the vice president-elect talk to you directly about your contributions are huge. Those are huge. And we need to deal with the morale of the whole country, but the morale of the workforce is hugely important. So I'm totally down with it.
In talking to your colleagues, do you feel that they've been sort of ignored from the White House over the past months? Do they feel that there's just not that appreciation?
Defined sort of. I don't think the vice president's done a pretty good job, but, you know, really it's not, we're just not seeing it, just not feeling it. You know, that's been the president has been on a very different tack and not directly engaged with COVID. And I think that that's been very problematic. And hopefully things are going to turn around tomorrow.
And Kamala Harris also spoke at the memorial service. We're going to pause for a minute to let listeners hear what she had to say.
And for many months, we have grieved by ourselves. Tonight, we grieve and begin healing together.
And Dr. Rutherford, how do you respond to her comments? I think a lot of Americans have felt isolated and that politicians just weren't understanding what they're going through. Do you think, again, that those kinds of words will make a difference?
Yes, I think they're huge. I think that makes a huge, huge difference. I think it not only makes a difference for, you know, healthcare workers, it makes a difference for the whole country who've had to, you know, basically suck this up in silence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we need to be, you know, this is a time for healing. It's a time for bringing people together. It's a time for acknowledging what's happened. You know, 400,000 dead is, you know, that's more than World War II.
Yeah. And thousands are dying still every day.
Yeah.
And so Biden, of course, is sworn in Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time. How quickly can we expect anything to change? Will things be different by, say, 5 p.m.? I'm hoping you'll say yes. But realistically, how quickly can we kind of begin to right this ship?
I think they'll start on day one. Everybody's poised to move and to make it happen. I don't think the outgoing administration has done them any particularly large favors. So they're going to have to get all this stuff figured out and figured out quickly. But I think we're, I mean, I've seen some of the plans. I think they are sage. They're careful. They're smart, and they address the things that need to be addressed, like, you know, understanding how much vaccine we have and how fast we can produce it.
What concretely do you expect to change quickly?
I think that, you know, we'll see a stimulus package. I think we'll see federal support for vaccination. Now, those are spending bills, so they'll have to get through the Congress. But, you know, we can always federalize some of the response and invoke National Guards and even regular military to help, or other federal assets to help with vaccinations, and not necessarily keep putting vaccines into arms, but just in terms of setting up large sites, crowd control, paper keeping, you know, all those kinds of things, making appointments, all that sort of stuff is really hugely important. Mm-hmm. Just to give a shout out in San Francisco, one of the real bulwarks of our whole contact tracing system have been the city librarians, who've been able to, you know, kind of, you know, they're excellent with people, and they're, you know, they're great with computers, and they've been terrific, you know, to the extent that there are people like that in the federal government who could come to help too. Great.
Do you think we should be deputizing librarians and other folks to actually get the vaccines in arms? Because I know healthcare workers are swamped taking care of patients.
I think it's not difficult to give vaccines. It's difficult to deal with the anaphylactic reactions. So I think we need to be a little careful about how much we farm this out. Mm-hmm. I think that, but there's so many pieces of this that don't involve putting needles in arms.
Mm-hmm. The logistics piece can be taken by somebody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just the shepherding around piece. Yeah.
Right. And a lot of non-Trump supporters are allowing themselves to feel a strange feeling a lot of us haven't felt in a long time, which is optimism. Do you think that's justified? Are you feeling a lot more optimistic than you were a couple of months ago?
Well, I'm always optimistic.
So you seem like an optimistic guy.
Glass half full and all that. I mean, I think we're kind of just going past the peak of the surge, the current surge. Mm-hmm. We have vaccinations coming out, even in heavily impacted areas of Los Angeles. We're starting to see drops in transmission. I think those are all, we're seeing fewer hospitalizations in California. I think those are all favorable signs. And it's, you know, it's huge. And this is going to be, it really is coincident with, you know, I mean, I think it's just happenstance that it's this way. But it's, you know, I think you have to be optimistic.
And Biden led the response to H1N1. Are you very familiar with how that went and what he may have learned from that pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I am. I think that's, you know, that's helpful to have gone down the path before. Now, you know, influenza is a different disease. It heavily infects children. Children are huge spreaders of influenza, unlike this disease, at least to the extent that we understand it. And so it's been, but it also kind of came and went fairly quickly, and we were able to get vaccine out, get vaccine production going, and get a substantial part of the population vaccinated. So yeah, I think it's helpful for him to have been down this road before.
And it seems like he will follow the lead of other countries, which have actually looked at data and science and crafting their response. What do you think we can learn from the experience of other countries as they've gone through this? Some did better than others, but
yeah, there are things to not learn, like in Sweden.
Exactly.
I mean, I look to France that really tried, you know, I mean, yeah, all the Asian countries, obviously, China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, those are all Vietnam. Those are all exemplars for how to do this stuff. If we look to the European countries, which may have sort of laws kind of closer to ours and it can control the population sort of at the level we can. I think the French have had a really good, you know, the French have been able to deal with this in a pretty straightforward way, and to move to more draconian measures when it's time to move to more draconian measures. They've also protected their schools. There's a wonderful picture in the New York Times from the summer of middle schoolers at the Claude Debussy, you know, Collège Claude Debussy, you know, supposed to the Steve Garvey Middle School like we have. It's, you know, if you hear kind of Claire de Lune in the background, but they've managed to keep the kids in school, which I think is, you know, I think is something that we should be trying to do more of.
Mm-hmm. San Francisco public schools are still closed, as are a lot of public schools in the East Bay. Do you think that's a mistake even as we go through this surge? Should they have been open?
No, I don't think it's a mistake in the midst of this surge. I think you have to be pretty brave to be opening schools right now. Let's let this thing drop down and then we can get the schools open.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see them open, say, in February or March? Or
it depends on what the levels are. You know, the governor said if you can get below 28 cases per 100,000 per day, you can petition to open schools. And it may even be a little high still. But as we start to come down, we're at almost 100 cases per 100,000 per day in California. Mm-hmm. If we start to come down, you know, to three quarters, you know, four fifths of that level, or, you know, a quarter or a fifth of that level, I should say, mm-hmm. Down into the kind of 20 cases per 100,000, or even better, 7 cases per 100,000, which is the purple to red transition. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we can start moving to open the schools. And interestingly, no one's brought this up, but the Pfizer vaccine is actually licensed for 16 and 17 year olds, as well mm-hmm. as 18 year olds. And I wonder whether we should be making a push for vaccinating adolescents right now so we can get them into high school.
Yeah, because most people assume high school opening is quite far off compared to elementary, but could be different if we went that way.
Yeah, well, unless you're 15 years old and you're hosed, but you know.
We'll be right back after a short break. You can support 5th and Mission and the newsroom that creates it by signing up for unlimited Chronicle access at sfchronicle.com/pod. And I was wondering what you know about Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Biden's Center for Disease Control appointment.
A real pro. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent choice. Excellent choice. Mm-hmm.
And do you think his goal of 100 million vaccinated in 100 days is realistic? Or is it one of those things that politicians throw out that they never actually achieve?
I think it's modest, actually.
Oh, really?
I think it's almost a gimme.
Wow. That's good news. Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, right now, I mean, in California, we're vaccinating sort of the level of 100,000 per day with one hand tied behind our back. So I think, you know, we can really push that number up. And to get, you know, 1 million people vaccinated a day would mean 150,000 a day in California if everybody does about what we do. I think that's very achievable. And I think we can go beyond that, especially if we get these larger vaccination centers set up.
Because mm-hmm. California is actually almost at the bottom for the percentage of vaccines it's actually gotten into arms that it's received.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what those statistics mean. I know what they mean, but whether everybody got the same denominator on a per capita basis, I don't know. The way it got allocated with the big health plans, perfectly reasonable way to do it. It's sort of hard to keep track of.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the federal government can do to improve the vaccination situation in the state? Because I'm hearing from readers, you know, every day that they're so frustrated trying to sign up their parents or.
I think that, first of all, we need a reliable supply of vaccine. And you know, we give Secretary Azar and the administration credit. They got the vaccines made. They made the investment. They didn't just turn this over to the private sector and say, you know, we'll buy it if you make it. You know, they went out and supported it, and they supported a parallel process for having enough syringes and PP and all that stuff. I think that, though, that it's a little unclear how much vaccine there is, how much is coming off the lines on any given day. I don't know it. I don't see it written down. Mm-hmm. And I think them having their hands on those data and being able to really advise the states. So San Francisco, for instance, got 1,700 doses. Mm-hmm. And what are they supposed to do with 1,700 doses?
Right.
You're getting a start in vaccinating a bunch more people. You know, it's better than nothing, but it's sort of hard to have kind of large scale vaccination when you have 1,700 doses.
Yeah. As one person told me, you could fit those in the trunk of a Honda Civic. Not very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you could take them to places where there's high levels of transmission.
That's true. When do you think we'll begin to obtain herd immunity and start to see our lives go back to normal?
We're going to, you know, attaining herd immunity is a gradual process, and you see benefits from it all along the way. And it's the difference between what the, I'm sorry not to get too mathy here, but the basic reproductive number, R sub zero,
yeah.
And the effective reproductive number, which takes into account what proportion of the population is immune. So when you see this start to turn down in Los Angeles, where they've had 1 million cases, right? figure there are probably 2 million people infected, probably double it to get to the right number of people infected. Out of 11 million, there are like 18% of people who've been infected, right? And you start to add vaccine on top of that, then you're up kind of in the 20%-ish range of people who've been, who are at least for now immune. You're going to start seeing that, seeing the R sub E start to accelerate, and you're going to see dry. I think you're just going to see an acceleration in the drop in cases, which leads to drops in hospitalizations, which leads to drops in ICU admissions, which leads to drops in mortality.
And so for people eager to get their lives back, what's the timeline?
I would say August 37th. You know, it's sometime this summer. It's late summer, I'd say. My goal is to go to the Olympics in Tokyo.
Do you think they'll actually happen?
Oh, yeah, it'll happen.
Oh, cool. I like your optimism. We should have you on more often. Every episode has been super depressing. And have you personally been vaccinated?
It's my card.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
I got one of those.
Yeah, I got vaccinated. I got the first dose the other day. I'm over 65 despite my youthful experience.
You have an appointment for your second dose?
Yeah. Yeah, they make it on the spot.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like? Any side effects?
The third time my wife hit my arm, it sort of hurt. And then the next day I didn't play tennis very well. So, you know, I rack it all up to vaccination, but, you know, no, not really.
Great. Well, you survived our serious questions. And if you'll...
Oh, those were the serious questions? Okay.
Yeah. If you bear with us, we have a lightning round.
Okay. Fire away.
I know you're an East Bay guy, so you can answer East Bay or San Francisco.
Yeah.
Where's your favorite place in the Bay Area to get a burrito?
burrito. You know, I have this real penchant for Korean tofu burritos, and I get them at that park on 4th, where they have the wagons on 4th Street. It's just north of UCSF campus.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, the little golf course.
Yeah, the little mini golf course there. Yeah.
What's your favorite movie filmed in San Francisco?
Probably The Maltese Falcon, but you can tell me it wasn't filmed in San Francisco.
Oh, that's okay. That's a good one. Where's your favorite place to get a stiff drink?
Oh, well, I have a favorite haunt over here on the East Bay. Mm-hmm. Wood Tavern on College Avenue.
Oh, nice. What was the last book you read?
Oh, I have a guy I play tennis with who's a priest, and he gave me I have a master's degree in medieval history. He gave me one of the Brother Cadfael mysteries, and I just finished reading that. It's sort of esoterica, you know, the Welsh and the English not liking each other. What a surprise, you know.
What was your first concert?
Somebody asked me the Spirit. 1968, probably 67, 68.
What's your favorite depiction of a doctor in the movies or on TV?
Oh, well, it has to be in MASH, you know?
Yeah, classic.
That was a big influence on me and you know, snarky behavior in residency.
What's a myth about doctors or nurses that you would like to debunk?
A myth. You know, I think that people, well, I was quite offended when the president was talking about how you could bill more if somebody had COVID-19, and I think that at least in a certain segment of society, doctors are viewed as money grubbing, and I think that's quite unfair.
Definitely. What are you most looking forward to about the pandemic ending? What is something you really want to do that you're not allowed to do now?
Go out to dinner with my wife.
Mm-hmm. And last question, what is something you always make sure to squeeze into your busy day?
Nothing. I mean, it's all I do is this.
You play tennis.
I play tennis about twice a week, but that's hardly a daily avocation. I go outside a little bit, walk around outside, just remember what there's an outside to this. But I really honestly work 18 hours a day. It's
oh my gosh.
It's wow. It's brutal. Brutal.
That is brutal. Well, I appreciate you making time for me. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, it's a real pleasure.
For more on the inauguration and what to expect from a Joe Biden administration, check out today's episode of the Chronicles It's All Political podcast. Joe Garofoli talks to the presidential scholar Elaine Kamark. She's the author of many books, including Why Presidents Fail, and she has a lot to say about Donald Trump. Thank you to George Rutherford for joining me today, to King Kaufman for producing this episode, and to you for listening.